Welcome, everyone. My name is Dr. Laura Cohen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Harriet and Kenneth Kupferberg Holocaust Center at Queensborough Community College at the City of University of New York. Our mission is to use the lessons of the Holocaust to educate current and future generations about the ramifications of prejudice, racism, and stereotyping. We're excited today to welcome Dr. Gary Okahiru, who will talk about oppression and resistance in America's World War II concentration camps. Today's event is also part of the KHC's 2020 National Endowment for the Humanities Colloquium entitled Internment and Resistance, Confronting Mass Detention and Dehumanization, and is presented in partnership with the Asian American Asian Research Institute at the City University of New York and the Nancy and David Wolfe Holocaust and Humanities Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's also connected to two initiatives at Queensborough Community College, the Kupferberg Holocaust Center's exhibition, virtual exhibition, The Concentration Camps, the Nazi System of Incarceration and Genocide, as well as the kickoff for the college's 2021 campus-wide Common Read text, George Takei's They Called Us Enemy. After the presentation, we'll have some time to answer a few questions, so please be sure to submit them on the Q&A button on your screen. And now I'd like to introduce Dr. Gary Okahiru, as well as Dr. Amy Traver, who will be moderating today's conversation. Dr. Gary Okahiru is Professor Emeritus of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University and a visiting professor of American Studies at Yale University. He's the author of 12 books, including Third World Studies, Theorizing Liberation, and The Boundless Sea, Self and History. He received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Studies Association and the Association for Asian American Studies, as well as received an honorary doctorate from the University of Yuku, Okinawa. Dr. Amy Traver is Professor of Sociology at Queensborough Community College. Her research interests include student success in community colleges, as well as the intersections of adoption, race, ethnicity, religion, and gender in American family life. She has published peer review articles in a wide variety of academic journals, including Teaching Sociology and Qualitative Inquiry, as well as is the co-editor of four scholarly volumes, including Humanistic Pedagogy Across the Disciplines. She was the faculty coordinator for the 2015 NEH series and a 2016 scholar in residence at the Kupferberg Holocaust Center, as well as was one of 26 faculty selected nationally for the 2019-2020 Mellon ACLS Community College Faculty Fellowship. And now I'd like to turn things over to Dr. Traver.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen. And good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Our plan is to start today's event with a conversation and then segue into an audience-directed Q&A session. So Dr. Okahiru, Gary, thanks for sharing your time and expertise with our community. We really appreciate it. I'm hoping, and I'm sure you are too, to cover a great deal of ground in our conversation. To do so, I'd like to start by taking a broad view of America's World War II concentration camps, then address Japanese Americans' experiences of and resistance to internment, and conclude with questions about you, your work, and the contemporary moment. So to start us off, in your book, Impounded, Dorothea Lange and the Censored Images of Japanese American Internment, you root the mass removal and confinement of Japanese Americans during World War II in the mid-19th century, when the U.S. forced Japan to open its doors to trade and influence. Can you expound on this argument and tell us why you begin your account of internment here?
Well, thank you very much, Amy. And thank you very much, all of you, for joining us in this, hopefully, conversation. I really appreciate this informal method. However, I'm a little kind of nervous not being able to see my audience. Goodness gracious, who am I talking to? Anyway, so let me try and hopefully I'll be able to compose myself. So your question about the entry of Japan into the world system begins really with Commodore Matthew Perry's sailing into Tokyo or Edo Bay in the mid-19th century to open Japan, in his words, to the rest of the world. What flowed from that opening is the Meiji Restoration in Japan, meaning the emperor system, a kind of overawe with the West and its technology because they could not fight against the armed ships that Perry came in with. And so their determination to, quote, westernize. And so that opening of Japan, not only for military, but also commercial purposes, and that expansion of the U.S. across the Pacific, an indication of U.S. imperial power, inspired Japan to sort of copy the Western model of westernization, meaning industrial capitalism, involvement in a world economy, by sending students abroad to learn in Europe and in the United States to bring back that knowledge to Japan, but also for the U.S., Hawaii mainly, and the West Coast, to recruit workers in Japan to bring them to the plantations of Hawaii and the orchards and railroads of the West. In other words, what I'm arguing is that Japanese did not immigrate to the United States. The United States went to Japan. And that going to Japan then brought Japanese into the United States, Hawaii, and the United States, the West Coast. And that entry then, along with the rising manufacturing industrial power of Japan and its competition with the United States as imperial powers in Asia and the Pacific, ultimately culminated with the Pearl Harbor, World War II, and the internment of Japanese Americans.
Thank you. So continuing this macro historical focus, can you explain how domestic and international law affected the legal conditions of the Japanese in the United States leading up to and including World War II?
Sure. Let me think now. The first thing I would want to say is that the United States illegally acquired Hawaii through conquest, terminating the Hawaiian Kingdom in the late 19th century. Hawaii thus became a property of the United States. That entry into the United States required United States laws to apply to Hawaii. And again, a kind of deep history. The laws that affected Japanese Americans profoundly began with the nation's founding, the United States. The first Naturalization Act, 1790, during the first Congress of the United States, specified that citizens through naturalization were to be restricted to, quote, free white persons. Think on that. Freedom, whiteness, personhood was defined by United States law. Freedom was purchased by enslavement. Whiteness purchased on the basis of non-whiteness, and personhood on the basis of alienation, meaning those who did not have the rights to citizenship and the rights of citizenship. That initial act that defined white nationalism precluded Japanese, indeed all immigrants who are non-white, from becoming U.S. citizens. And that had enormous consequences for them throughout their stay in the United States, being restricted from land ownership, or even renting, or any sharecropping land, and so forth. So their suspension of liberties thus hinged to a large degree on their inability to become U.S. citizens. Now, that lasted until my time, believe it or not. I remember my grandfather, who could not become a U.S. citizen until 1952, 1952. So much of the nation's history excluded that possibility for Japanese to become citizens of the United States. And I remember my grandfather taking the oath, affirming loyalty to the United States and thereby becoming a citizen. And that was after 1952. So that's one domestic law that had an enormous impact on Japanese American rights and claims to the nation. The international one would be 1908, the Gentlemen's Agreement, which was not a law, but an agreement between the United States and Japan. The United States pressing Japan to restrict the migration of workers into the United States. Now, this is why I consider all Asian immigration before World War II as migrant labor. That is that these people, beginning with the Chinese, Japanese, Koreans, Filipinos, South Asians, were recruited to work in the United States as workers, temporary workers. That was the idea. In any case, in 1908, the United States prevailed upon Japan to restrict giving passports to Japanese workers because they were no longer desired. And thereafter, of course, the United States recruited then Filipinos to replace the Japanese. And that happened to the Chinese in 1882 when they were excluded, and then the U.S. recruited Japanese to replace them. So then Filipinos, then South Asians, and then Mexicans. So our lives are connected in those ways.
Thank you. There's so much to disentangle in terms of resonances with today that I hope that we can get to some of that in the audience Q&A. But for now, I'd like to transition to considering experiences of oppression and resistance in America's World War II concentration camps. Given the age of many of the students in attendance today, can you tell us a bit about the lives of young Japanese Americans in the camps? In what ways, for example, did concentration contribute to the rise of youth culture and impact parental authority in families? How did it mediate their transition into adulthood, for example?
Yeah, it's a very good question, because I think that the experience affected different generations differently. And clearly, I'm sorry, I'm getting choked up because I just took a sip of tea and it stuck in my throat. Just like my mother, as she aged, she often choked on her drink and food. I'm sorry, dear folks. Anyway, okay. It had as much to do, that is, the differentials of generation experience had much to do with how they were treated by the administration of the camps. So one of the clear identifications by the administrators was to privilege the young people over the older generation. Now, the older generation, they perceived as too Japanese, as a bad influence on the younger generation. I'm just speaking broadly. It varied from camp to camp, but this was a kind of general sort of treatment, if not policy. And so they, the administrators, sought to exclude the Issei, or the first generation, the older generation, from any kind of camp governance or any kind of position of authority, and then privilege the younger generations because they were U.S. citizens. Now, of course, the older generation, even if they wanted to, could not become U.S. citizens because of that 1790 Act. But the younger generation thus had various kinds of privileges far beyond their years. In other words, for a lot of Asian societies, the elder people are the ones who hold wisdom, authority, deference. The younger people are waiting and they learn from the older folk. the roles were reversed in the camps by the administrators deliberately. And so that kind of privileging of the younger generation allowed them greater mobility than the older generation. So, for example, some of them were able to continue their education by leaving camp and going on to college. In the camps themselves, many of them took positions of authority, leadership, community relations. They issued the papers, newspapers for the camp and so forth. Their facility with English allowed them that kind of conversation ability and so forth, whereas the older generation mainly spoke Japanese. In some camps, the directors forbid Japanese language in public meetings and so forth, you see. So that kind of favoritism then led to a kind of division between the older generation and the younger generation. Now, if you're talking about even younger people, not in their teens, but in their, say, K through 12 years, many of them had no really understanding about their containment, their lack of freedom. And many of them found it far better than their lives on farms, isolated from other children. And so them being all together, many of them had a great old time associating. So they remember that as like a summer camp for that younger group. Anyway, so there are differential kinds of experiences and memories of the camp, yeah.
Interesting. Thank you. That's fascinating. And I know you've explored gender and other axes of difference in the camps, so maybe we can get to that in the Q&A as well. So despite internment's impact on the culture of family, in your book, The Columbia Guide, you argue that cultural socialization and persistence, specifically parents' quiet struggle for the possession of their children's minds and habits in relation to Japanese culture, was a key means by which Japanese Americans resisted internment. This is fascinating. Can you tell us more about this everyday culture-based resistance?
Sure. First of all, to understand resistance, one has to understand oppression. That is, resistance is against oppression, and that's what I mean. And I think the oppressive nature of these camps was not the loss of rights as citizens. Two-thirds of the people interned were U.S. citizens, so they were deprived of their constitutional rights. That is, to be charged with a crime and the reason for their confinement. I don't think that's the, it is oppressive, clearly, but I don't think that's the full nature of that oppression. I think the ultimate nature of that oppression was a denial of their humanity, their essential humanity. And that involved the Japanese as enemy during World War II. The conflation of the Japanese enemy in the Pacific with the Japanese in the United States. And that conflation was easily made because, as the general in charge of the West Coast said, a Jap is a Jap. And you can sort of teach them American values. You can teach them how to vote and serve in a democracy, but their racial strains remain undiluted. In other words, there's a kind of genetic quality to this Japanese enemy that deserves special treatment. And that special treatment, a denial of humanity, involves things like not having them call themselves by their own names. They were assigned numbers instead of names, so they had to remember their numbers as opposed to their names. They were herded onto trucks designed to transport cattle, horses, taken to county fairgrounds, horse stalls, where they could still smell the manure in their so-called barracks, and they had to clean that and make their own sort of bedding out of straw and so forth. kind of essential denial of humanity was the treatment accorded to enemies in the mind of their confiners, their prisoner, our guards. Also a kind of denial of a future. You know, humans, I think, require a measure of agency, a control over their own lives, and a kind of vision that there is going to be a tomorrow. Many Japanese Americans didn't know if they were going to be executed or if they would have a tomorrow. Now, I remember on my first pilgrimage to one of the former camps in Manzanar, Southern California, I was wandering through the ruins of the camp. There's nothing standing. It was just the foundations of the buildings left. I found this straggly old tree growing there. And at the top were these beautiful cherry blossoms blowing in the desert wind. This was spring. And this cherry tree was blooming. And I thought to myself, someone planted this cherry tree. And that someone must have been a Japanese person. In planting that cherry tree, that person said, I have a future here. I am going to tend this tree, see it grow, see it bloom in the spring. And of course, the cherry tree and the cherry blossom had specific meaning to Japanese culture. Now then, this idea about Japanese culture as resistance, you see, stand in the face of the denigration of Japanese culture. They were a Japanese race with a particular kind of culture and belief systems, and we need to thus punish them for that. Well, I'm going to build a reflecting pond here in Manzanar. And from that, we can watch the mountain, the cascades in the back. And beyond that is Japan. The quiet acts then of these cultural sort of manifestations and a belief system in nature, Shintoism, this belief of humans and their relationship to nature, to me, bespoke a resistance, a resilience on a people who refuse to be dehumanized, separated from their language and culture.
Oh, that's very powerful. Thank you for that. And the future orientation that you speak of, I know it probably resonates a lot with people on a lot of different levels right now. So thank you. That was beautiful. As we wind down our conversation and begin to prepare for questions from our audience, I'd like to consider how we remember and make sense of Japanese American internment in a moment today marked by a significant increase in anti-Asian hate crimes. During World War II, Japanese Americans were interned because of race, not individual guilt. And in your book, Storied Lives, Japanese American Students in World War II, you explore a topic that you mentioned before, students studying outside the camps. And you outline an interventionist practice that defied the racism that constituted the camps, white Americans' assistance to Japanese American students attending college outside the military zone. Can you tell us more about this practice and how it relates to contemporary calls for and studies of anti-racism?
Yeah. I think the World War II experience of Japanese Americans is the most written about event in Asian American studies by far. And there are various reasons for that. But one of the main themes emanating for that is the result of racism in the United States. And in fact, in the Civil Liberties Act of 1988 and in the remembrances ever since then, it is a remembrance of war, racism, and a failure of political leadership. So racism stands prominently in that experience. Now, of course it does, but there's also other factors. And I see nationalism as not just a racial construct, that is a racialization of citizenship and rights, but also as a gendered construct, the place of women in the domestic sphere as opposed to the political sphere, and women only getting the right to vote in 1920 and still unable to break that glass ceiling of total leadership of the United States, is also a sexualized construct. Anyway, I'm deviating from your question. So anyway, let's see now. I forgot your question in my deviation. Oh, okay. So racism does not stand alone, you see? Racism accompanies and intersects with other forms of oppression, like patriarchy. Okay. So I think that the question of racism, however, requires the opposition, anti-racism. We witness that in our contemporary moments around the mass mobilization for Black Lives Matter across racialized divides, across class lines, across gender, sexual, and so forth, orientations. Anyway, we have those kinds of intersections today. But I thought it really important to not essentialize Japanese. That is, all Japanese are the same, so they all behave in a particular way. No, we're all distinctive too as individuals. We behave collectively, but also we have our individual selves. Likewise, white people. Let's not just generalize all white people as all races, and thus they were in favor of these camps during World War II. No, there were whites who were anti-racist also. And these remain true friends of their Japanese neighbors, taking risks because they were risking being vilified by their fellow white neighbors and so forth. And it took courage for them to stand up for Japanese. Anyway, so we have little acts of kindness on the behalf of white people towards Japanese. Just like, for example, I'm going to keep your house tidy while you're gone and make sure that it doesn't get vandalized. To a larger project like this student relocation committee that was formed by educators and religious leaders to try to extricate the young people from the camps to continue their education back east. And that's why I wrote that book, Storied Lives, about that act of anti-racism. Now, anti-racism also is not like a gift, a patronizing gift of a superior group over an inferior group, an oppressed group. I think it's a collective effort. And so when it's truly sort of dialogical, collaborative, in the sense that both display agency towards better ends, then I think it is an act of anti-racism. But I can understand patronizing kinds of behavior that assumes the mantle of anti-racism. I'm not talking about that.
Yeah. And that comes across very clearly in that text, which is based in oral histories and such an important data source for us. So thank you. So my last question for you kind of gets at a comment that you made before about Japanese internment being a core area of interest in Asian American studies. And Elaine Kim argues for the need to move the field of Asian American studies beyond railroads and internment. That's her language. In the Columbia Guide, which you published in 2001, you point to a number of emerging themes of space or region, gender, the law, and resistance in that moving field. Are there new themes or areas of inquiry that you'd add to that list today? And where do you see the field heading?
Yeah, I would. One real area is religion. You know, like my generation of Asian Americanists were largely anti-religious. I myself began as a budding theologian. I actually wanted to engage in existentialism, Black liberation theology, Latin American liberation theology, but was curtailed from advancing into that field by racism, actually. And so I became a historian. But the point is that we cannot ignore the central role played by religion within Asia. Clearly, all of the world's great religions emanate from Asia, in fact. And then also in the lives of Asian Americans, the role that religion plays. Recently, in the anti-Muslim, anti-Islamic sentiments in not only the United States, but in Western Europe, we see the importance of religion again. The rise of Christianity against Islam. Ancient 11th century, with the Crusades and the belief to retake the Holy Land. We still have that legacy today. And by the way, I consider the Holy Land or Palestine and Israel and that area as Asia, because the ancient Greeks conceived of the world, whatever was east of them was the Aurea, Asia. Anyway, so religion, I think, is a really important area. The other is that I think we need to, in all of our fields of study and ethnic studies, break down what we erected over the last like 40, 50 years, meaning walls between ourselves as racialized groups. So like we have African American studies, we have Asian American studies, Latinx studies, Native American studies, and the people who are experts in that area who is able to study themselves are themselves. And we talk to ourselves, our students are largely of our own group. And we reject outside interference, seeing that as co-optation or some kind of misrepresentation of ourselves. And while I was a partisan in that move to speak for ourselves and to self-determine, I think it also is a dead end, that we need to understand our relations, our connections across those divides. That's another big area of movement. And a kind of final big area of movement, I think, is to break down these barriers again between racialized studies and, say, gender, sexuality, and in my opinion, disability and ability, class, and nation. I think we need to engage all of these, cutting across those divides that are created by those with power to create them and to divide and rule. I think we need to understand that.
Thank you. Lots of work to be done. And we have a lot of students in the audience capable of doing that work. So I hope they're feeling inspired. Perhaps I can trouble you with one more question for the benefit of those students. What advice would you give to the young writers and thinkers at QCC who might be considering their own connections to and identities within their cultures? What message do you have for those students who might be feeling marginalized in or made invisible by our larger historical and literary conversations.
Don't succumb. Don't succumb. Resist. Resist those forces that seek to demean, to marginalize you. Each of us is important, valuable, and each of our lives connect one with the other. I reject entirely this sort of individualism ideal that might have arisen from the humanism of Europe. But this idea that each of us exists alone and that we can then self-determine, the sovereign self is not sovereign. And in fact, we are connected. And so do not succumb to these attempts to divide us and to isolate us and make us feel powerless, because I think individually and collectively, we can work for a better future.
Thank you for that. And with that, I'd love to turn the question and answer portion over to our students and to the other folks in attendance. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Okihiro and Dr. Traver. This has been really powerful. And as Dr. Hiro, you just mentioned resist, I'm starting to get very emotional about it, because I think it's really important. And when so much of the dialogue that's taking place now is around violence and oppression, to really be able to think more positively and more constructively is absolutely inspirational, and I think really required of us to rise to this moment. One of the questions I have for you is, when you spoke about to understand resistance, you need to understand oppression. And we've talked about gender, religion, age, prioritizing one perspective over another. One of the questions is about cultural resistance from a kinesthetic standpoint. And could you talk a little bit about what styles of musical and verbal expressions became forms of resistance for Japanese Americans?
That's a really good question. And I don't know if I'm the person to respond to that. By the way, wisdom is knowing what you don't know. Let's see. Let me think about that question. Like, what form of music or something might best express resistance among Asian Americans broadly or whatever? I don't believe that. There are a whole range of, Asian Americans, and a whole range of music for which, resistance might speak, you know. Now, if oppression is a tool to restrict our agency, then creativity and the ability to sort of transcend those kinds of boundaries is, I think, a good move. All right. So like me, liking European classical music, especially Baroque music, might seem like a, wait a minute, you're genetically predisposed to say, no, Asian music is the number one thing in my life. Well, I don't believe that kind of junk. You know what I mean? I believe culture changes. And I think the natures of oppression and resistance change, dynamic and changing over time and things. And so I think it's incumbent upon us then. Now, I know that co-optation, say like hip hop, for example, might be an issue. I understand that, you know, but I don't believe in sort of authenticity and the maintenance of authentic cultures, because I like to see punctures and flows between cultures, because I think that happens anyway. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm sorry.
It sounds like you do know, though, and I think it's really important that to think about the point you're making about different identities and being able to come together, and what are ways that we can do that collectively. I'm curious, there's a question that's come in regarding One of the attendees has said he's seen a few movies about the amazing contribution of the Japanese Nisei Battalion during World War II. And how do you think these soldiers felt about what they were doing, considering that many of their relatives were being held in concentration camps?
Who? What people were these outside the camp?
The Japanese Nisei Battalion during World War II.
Wait a minute. Did you say... is this the military you're talking about?
I think so, yeah. I think it's talking about...
Okay. So the Nisei who are second generation, they were U.S. citizens, and they were actually, I would say, compelled to serve in the U.S. military. And this is my father's dog tag, World War II. My father served in the U.S. military, but I don't say he served voluntarily or for the same reason that many other Americans served. By the way, I carry this like my garlic. Whenever I encounter racism, I bring this out and show that. But anyway, the reason I say that is because, like, my father, when he was training, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. And he and the others who were in the military were then quickly surrounded by white soldiers, confined to their barracks, and armed guards patrolled the perimeters where they were. In other words, they were seen as the enemy. My father, in the military, was the enemy. When they trained in Wisconsin, they assumed the role of Japanese enemy against white soldiers who were training. When some of them were sent down to Mississippi, they were hidden in bushes with meat tied to their necks for dogs to sniff them out in the jungle, which was for jungle training in the islands in the Pacific. And the idea was that Japanese had a particular smell that dogs could determine. Now, that kind of treatment of these soldiers, you see, and they were expected to go and shed their blood for that nation who treated them that way? Well, they did. And I think a lot of them did, because they knew that the future of children like me, his child, depended upon their act. If they had not acted in behalf of the United States and shed their blood, they would have no reason or little reason to say, listen, I fought for this country. I deserve the rights of citizenship. Now, my father's brothers in Japan served in the Japanese military. And his father died, probably, as a consequence of the nuclear holocaust in Hiroshima. Now, was my father a patriot in the same sense that an American with the full rights of citizenship, or African Americans who were also in segregated units, like the Japanese in segregated units? What I'm saying thus is that the service of people of color, mainly African Americans and Asians, or Japanese in this case, were mixed. So I wouldn't say that our claims to patriotism are the same as the claims to patriotism of other soldiers who serve. And what I'm saying thus is that while I saw that the recruitment of Japanese in the camps was an appeal to patriotism, their reasons for going and for dying in larger numbers than many of the other units of American soldiers was a sacrifice made for the future of their families in this country.
That's incredibly powerful. And talking about the layers of experience and why people serve and what that means from a national perspective and how that impacts family and memory. And there's a question that's come up about whether we call, when it talked a little bit about geographic space and place, and you had mentioned Manzanar and visiting, and it was in ruins. And frequently when we're talking about Japanese internment camps in the States, we're calling them internment camps. We're not calling them concentration camps. And one of the focuses of the exhibition at our center is really helping students and visitors understand what different kinds of incarceration and camps look like. And I ask you this because you had mentioned the nuclear holocaust in Hiroshima. And frequently, that's not a word that we connect. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about language and how we categorize things.
Yeah, language is so important. It's not like politically correct speech or silencing, trivializing the use of language, because language carries meaning, and those meanings are really important. Now, as far as I understand, right, the first use of the term concentration camp was during the South African War, 1899 to 1902, when the British soldiers fought against the Afrikaners, Dutch people, rounded up the women and children for not any crime that they committed, but for their ethnicity, that they were Dutch. And the reason for that was then all those outside of those camps were considered free fire zones. They destroyed Africana farms, equipment, killed them indiscriminately. So these were civilians for no crime that they committed, but just that they belonged to a particular ethnic group. In 1936, Franklin Roosevelt, as president, asked his military commanders to put away suspicious Japanese, not for anything they did, but just because they were Japanese, to put them in, his words, concentration camps. And that was an accurate term, and he used it not just once, but at least twice in correspondence that I found. Because concentration camps were places for people, for their religion, for their ethnicity, for their race, for reasons other than having committed any civil offense, confined into these places. Now, of course, the Nazi Holocaust was abhorrent and indecent in the extreme, right? And they were extermination camps in addition to concentration camps. Anyway, so I think the terms are really important. Like the government calls the Japanese removal, relocation, evacuation. These conjure up natural disasters, and that we're doing this for the good of the people being removed forcibly, losing their lifetimes of labor to put them into these camps. The words have meaning.
And to build on that with words that have meaning, and, you know, so much of this experience in the States is about presence and absence, what we see, what we don't see, what we acknowledge, what we see, what we don't want to talk about. There's a question that's come in from John Yee. He is one of the instructors at Queensborough Community College. He's leading this year's Common Read. And he asked the question related to resilience and succumbing. He'd like to know more about your thoughts on recent events that have occurred during the pandemic, particularly with the uptick in racism and hate crimes against Asian Americans in the U.S. and worldwide. And do you have any advice for the students who are attending today who might be feeling marginalized and silenced?
Yeah, that's a very serious question. And it wasn't helped. In fact, it was advanced by then President Trump, and his language of the pandemic as a Chinese virus. And even after his removal from office, we have horrific kinds of events against mainly seniors, Asians, but not always, men and women being attacked physically and then abused verbally and spat upon and so forth. The rise in anti-Asian violence, which happened also after 9/11, mainly against West and South Asians victimized for the events of 9/11. But in any case, how to respond to that, I just don't know, you know. But one cannot feel, one should remember that there are many more who support your dignity and your worth. That's the comforting thing. I see those acts as continuities and as consistent with U.S. history. But I also see them as individual acts that are, that can be aberrations. But I remember, and I remember this though, I see this as continuities. And that with education, I believe, because I'm an educator, we can change things. If we understand our common humanity and our needs to live on this planet as one people.
And to build on that, talking about common humanity, there has been a progression because we're talking about this openly today. And one of the questions is, you know, the progression of being able to talk about these issues. And you talked initially at the start about the privileging of young people's voices versus the older generation. And one of the questions is about how did subsequent generations begin to overcome and begin to break this barrier of silence, even though it was something many survivors were determined not to speak about?
Yeah, which was a common thing for victims who are oftentimes victimized for nothing that they can change, whether it's their gender, sexuality, or race. So kind of feeling of hopelessness. But I forgot the question.
In terms of how did the older generation who was not comfortable talking about this, how did subsequent...
I got it. Okay. So... like victims of the kind I say, we often don't want to talk about it because we don't want to bring up and relive the trauma of that experience. How did we come as a community, Japanese Americans? Well, it was a long process. And my friend, who is no longer with us, Edison, said that when Japanese were able to speak about the injustice of their treatment, they became Americans. Now, the reason he was saying that is because we did not feel that we were entitled to claim the rights that all American citizens claim. And that was the reason for our silence. And that was the measure of the oppression. That was the lesson we learned, that because we were Japanese, we were treated in that way. And thus, a kind of self-denial. And so, a silence. Now, when the redress reparations movement took place in the 1970s and 80s, I remember the Japanese community being severely divided. The older generation mainly said, no, let bygones be bygones, keep quiet. And just move on because we're becoming better. We're becoming more successful. We're finding our place. The younger generation said, hell no. We're going to protest against this injustice done to us. They were speaking as Americans, you see. Now, in the community that I live, San Jose, the younger generation wanted to bring to the community draft resistors, people, Japanese Americans who resisted the draft. And we, our generation, saw them as the real patriots, not those who went and served in the military, you see? And that was one of the reasons that question came up, I think. The San Jose community said, no, we're not letting any hall open to draft resistors because they were un-American. Now, you see, so that debate still continued up into the 1970s and 80s. Now, with the passing of that generation and the younger generations having greater confidence in themselves as Americans, speech is possible.
Dr. Traver, I'd like to turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. I'm wondering if I might ask you one more question, because I see its resonance across some of the questions that you just fielded and some of the comments that you made. So if we might conclude on this one question, I'd appreciate it. On the topic of resistance and breaking down barriers in terms of our action and work together, in The Boundless Sea, Self and History, you argue that the best model for understanding Japanese American resistance to internment is Africans' reactions to European colonization and enslavement in the U.S. I know that this is a big area of your work now. Can you tell us more about the power and applicability of this model?
Well, you know, when I started with the opening, so-called, of Japan by Commodore Perry, I was thinking about going back even farther to 1900, when W.E.B. Du Bois in London said the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. Right? Now, he said that in London, which was the seat of the British Empire, 1900, when the British Empire was the largest empire on earth. And what he meant was that the world was divided between the colonizers and the colonized, and that the rising up of the colonizers against colonialism was the problem of the 20th century. Europeans began that problem with the imperial colonial project. The Third World was rising up for self-determination, for democracy, and that rising up constituted the problem, well, the solution to the problem begun by the colonizers. Now, that problem continued right through to World War II and till today. That is colonialism, neocolonialism now, is still the problem of the 21st century. And that model of resistance to it, meaning anti-colonialism and anti-racism, racism being the ideology that sustains the material relations of colonialism, is still a problem today. And the solution is anti-racism. But like I said, I think racism is also connected intimately to gender, sexuality, ability, and so forth. So I think it's intersectional, multiple and intersectional. Now, the model provided by Africans and African Americans against colonialism and colonial rule is what I had in mind.
Thank you. And thank you for being with us today, for speaking so honestly and candidly with us. It's really been a pleasure and a joy, and I'm just so glad we were able to do this. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate this forum very much. Thank you, Laura and Amy, for arranging this.
Thank you. We're really grateful for your time and for your insights, and really being able to also position your insights within the contemporary context. I think that's just absolutely critical. Thanks to everyone who's logged in today. We really appreciate it. On behalf of the Harriet and Kenneth Kupferberg Holocaust Center at Queensborough Community College, thank you. We hope you all stay safe and healthy. Be well.